Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James and Spade.
G'day, everyone.
It is Friday the 19th, and this is episode 43 of the podcast. Huge show for you guys coming up.
He's already gone. 19th of Jan.
Yeah, I know. Well, all right, no podcast this week. Now, of course, we've got a big show for you guys coming up this week. We have Jacinta Price, Alice Springs Town Councillor, going to be talking about Australia Day, what it means to her, whether or not we should change the date. And we're also going to be talking to Andrew Bushnell about a few criminal justice matters that have popped up in Australia over the last few weeks. So that'll be a really interesting chat as well.
Research fellow from the IPA.
Yes, indeed. Nina, welcome. Nina, great to have you as always.
Thank you very much.
Or as we like to call her, the podcast Trump.
Yes, she's got her finger on the button, as we were saying to her before, and her button's bigger than ours. She can take us off air at any time.
We don't have a button, so Nina likes to rub it in our face.
Yes.
So you're in our memories at the moment.
What's up?
So you're in my mercy at the moment. So if I don't like anything that you say, I just say, turn off that button and then that's it.
Yeah, it's like a 2 minute podcast.
Yeah, we're gone. We're gone forever. They'll never hear from us again. Now, let's get into some stories here. So Australia Day, obviously, now that it's coming around, everyone's up in arms about whether or not we should change the date or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been a few developments this week, Pete.
Absolutely. So, of course, we've got the same debate we have every year. And we'll be talking with Jacinta Price about that in much more detail a little bit later on. Yesterday, we had the launch from the Australian Conservatives, Cory Bernardi's party, alternate top 100 songs for people to play on Australia Day. Of course, Triple J have moved their Hottest 100 count to another day because they're so brave.
Yeah, the day after.
Yeah. And they'll all be going to work and not having the public holiday.
Yep.
Anyway, so the Australian Conservatives released this playlist with Australian artists, Savage Garden, Hilltop Hoods, a few others.
I was going to say, did you see the top three?
I did not see the top three.
Okay, do you want to guess the top three?
Jimmy Barnes, Working Class Man, is that?
No, not in there.
Really?
Not top three.
Jimmy Barnes is in it.
Yeah, he's in it, but he's not top three.
So, okay, I don't know.
Okay, so we got Down Under, Men at Work, number one.
Okay.
Don't know about that.
It's a good tune.
Yeah, but K-San was number two. I thought that should have been number one. So, is Cory Bernardi the voice of the Australian people? This is my question.
It's... Well, that's a question for the electorate.
Yeah, yeah. And then you're the voice coming in at number three.
Yeah, good sing-along. Good 4 a.m. just before you get kicked out of the pub songs. Nina, stop trying to pretend you don't know what I'm talking about.
I don't watch The Voice.
The Voice by John Farnham. Like,
it's two different things.
Oh, that's the Voice, the
television program.
Yeah, but that's
I kind of lost on that.
Yeah. Yeah, sorry. So, Nina, you're not going to be tuning in tomorrow. Or whenever it is.
So, could I read out the Darren Hayes quote?
Yes,
Darren Hayes
go
of Savage
ahead.
Garden. I do not want to be associated with you, your party, or your views, he wrote on Twitter to Cory Bernardi. Obviously, remove my music from this stunt or expect contact from my publisher. I stand with Indigenous Australians. I always have. So another one of those who just assumes all Indigenous Australians think the same thing.
Yeah, and here's the other part of this. So, like, we've had this guy saying you don't have permission and a few other musicians are like, you don't have permission to use my music. Yes, he does. Like, this is granted a Spotify playlist. I've done that. Do I not have permission?
Are they going to give the money back for the plays they get?
Is that exactly. Look, all 3 cents they'll make out of it with Spotify's artist deals. But it's just like, I just, you do not have my permission.
He
definitely does.
And I've got one more quote from Cory Bernardi himself. This is of Hilltop Hoods. I actually do enjoy their music. I don't have to enjoy their political or social activism to say, hey, they're talented, they're Australian, and they've got some boppy little songs that I kind of enjoy.
Yeah, this is something that John's been saying, where it's like, you don't have to agree with the artist to enjoy their music. There's not a legal requirement of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, there's no way in hell Cory Bernardi listens to the Hilltop Hoods.
He says they've got some boppy little songs that he kind of enjoys. Yeah, that was on...
They are three words I would not use to describe the Hilltop Hoods.
And he made those comments on Radio National, responding to the Hilltop Hoods, who told him to go F himself.
I don't think anyone who listens to Radio National listens to the Hilltop Hoods. I don't know, the Venn diagrams are at all linked. Anyway, so other big news on Australia Day this week. So yesterday, Thursday the 18th, the Australia Institute released their poll saying that 56% of Australians don't mind when the Australia Day is held, just as long as it is a national day of celebration. But what they didn't do is release the statistics for the obvious question, do you want the date changed?
Mm.
Like, there's just like the idea that Australia wants an Australia Day. So do they ask that question? Do they not get the answer they wanted and then not release it in the poll figures?
Seems like an odd omission.
Very odd omission. So don't want to tease it out too much, but the IPA's got some work coming out next week around a similar thing. So make sure you guys are liking us on Facebook, following us on Twitter, and checking our website. That'll follow up with a few things there. So I think you guys will find that really interesting. Pete, let's talk fake news awards.
Our specialty.
Right, you are, Pete. But Donald Trump has been threatening for a few weeks to release his own fake news awards.
Yes.
I have been waiting with bated breath. They got delayed and then delayed again. But yesterday he finally released them. Pretty interesting stuff. So basically it's just a list of headlines that Trump didn't really like. Sorry, stuff like the winner was the New York... Sorry, reading here. Number one, the New York Times' Paul Krugman. I mean, pretty easy target to go after. But New York Times' Paul Krugman claimed on the day of President Trump's historic landslide victory that the economy would never recover. And then there's a screenshot of a headline article. Paul Krugman says markets will never recover from Trump. Dow hits record high. But and then a few other things like that.
I like that one.
Yes.
He's a nightmare, that bloke.
Oh, terrible. ABC News' Brian Ross chokes in full capitals and sends markets into a downward spiral with false news report. And then you've got like a graph that just shows how the Dow Jones recovered afterwards. I love this. Trump 100% was just able to spout these off the top of his head. He didn't need to Google anything. He didn't need to go, what was the wording of that one again? He's got it all locked away. Like, he knows exactly what these tweets were.
It would have taken him ages to finalize the list.
Yeah, exactly.
And like the fact there's 11 is like he just couldn't decide on the top 10.
Yeah, exactly. Like he couldn't decide between 10 and 11.
Some of them are pretty... So some of them are actually legitimate.
Yeah, exactly.
Time reported that Trump removed a bust of Martin Luther King Jr. from the Oval Office.
Yeah.
And then later said... Oh, no, it was just a misunderstanding. It got legs of its own.
Yeah, and then the other one where it's like he didn't shake the hands of the Polish Prime Minister and because of one photo where he's not, and then the next photo is them shaking hands. That would annoy me if I was Trump. Like, you are actually shaking the hands of someone, but then the whole world is saying, like, oh, you know, what a brave stand the Polish Prime Minister took against you. It's like, come on.
So brave.
Yeah.
There is a broader point here about loss of faith in mainstream media.
Yes, and I have a narrower point.
That's pretty standard.
Yeah, which is every politician in the world is going, I wish I had the guts to do this.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, every politician would be so jealous that Trump's just like, fake news awards, we're doing it.
Why nothing of this?
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
It should
be noted that the Young IPA podcast was not on that list.
No.
So we are a Trump-approved media outlet.
I think we got an honourable mention, but we didn't get into the final 11.
Yeah. He's going to do a good news awards later, isn't he?
I don't know.
Fake news. I don't know. I thought I read that
maybe
somewhere.
Maybe we'll get into the top 11.
Yeah. We'll aim for next year.
Pete already putting down the hard work. Pete, let's talk John's article.
Yeah, okay. So John Roskam had an article, as he always does, in the Fin Review every fortnight. He had one last Friday. I think it was the first one of the year. So he likes to sort of set off, you know, you start broad with the start of the year.
It's like the first episode of a TV show in the new season.
Yeah.
Just sort of set the table.
Yeah.
Not a huge plot line episode. Just set the table for what's going on.
Yeah. So that's, I think, what he was going for. He said that, so he did the Lowy Institute poll of 2017, which revealed that only 60% of Australians believe democracy is preferable to any other kind of government. According to the survey of Australians between the ages of 16 and 25, commissioned by the Institute of Public Affairs in 2016, only 31% of young people in this country believe it's important to live in a democracy. So, 2018 must be the year where politicians give us faith once again in democracy, I think is the general point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, talking about Donald Trump just before, that was the kind of thing that got him elected, was this: the Americans were so angry, so disappointed that they needed some firestorm to come in and just start, you know, doing things.
Yep.
Anyway, we've got one more thing we're going to talk about before we go to our interview. So, obviously, Jordan Peterson, really famous guy at the moment, talking a lot about freedom of speech, talking a lot about... you might have seen him talk about how Canada's made it now illegal to not refer to someone as their preferred gender pronoun. So, if someone transitions and they say, this is now what you have to call me, Jordan Peterson sort of saying, actually, I don't have to call anyone anything. I can just make up my own mind. So he's in the UK at the moment, sort of on a tour of his new book, The Antidote to Chaos. And a few pretty good radio interviews happening. Like, obviously, a really smart guy, completely completely underestimated by the journalist he was going against. Did a George Bush moment. And then... my favourite one was the one which is going quite viral at the moment. It's a Channel 4 interview with the British journalist Cathy Newman. We're going to play a clip for you guys now because I can't do it justice.
Why should your right to freedom of speech trump a trans person's right not to be offended?
Because in order to be able to think, you have to risk being offensive. I mean, look at the conversation we're having right now. You know, like, you're certainly willing to risk offending me in the pursuit of truth. Why should you have the right to do that? It's been rather uncomfortable.
Well, I'm very glad I put you on the spot.
Well,
I'm
very glad that I have exercised my point. You get my point. It's like, you're doing what you should do, which is digging a bit to see what the hell's going on. So, and that is what you should do. But you're exercising your freedom of speech to certainly risk offending me. And that's fine. I think more power to you, as far as I'm concerned.
So you haven't sat there and... I'm just trying to work that out. I mean...
Ha, gotcha.
You have got me. I'm trying to work that through in my head. Yeah. It took a while.
It did, yeah.
It took a while.
I think at that point, you have to resign on air. Like, if you are lost for words for 5 seconds, you got to go.
If you don't...
Cut to commercial, next person, and then when they come back, it's a new presenter.
She's got to have a bit of background... You know, if you haven't got a response, just cut to chat.
Mm.
Just cut to mindless babble.
Yeah, exactly. Which is basically what this podcast
is. Yeah.
Cool. So we should also note that Jordan Peterson has announced his tour of Australia. And he'll be coming out quite soon. You guys can go to truearrowevents.com/Dr.Peterson-tour. It's going to be talking in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. That website will have all the details about where you can buy tickets, what nights you can go. I know tickets are selling pretty fast. It's already pretty hard to get one in Melbourne, so make sure you guys are going quickly.
If you didn't get that URL or you can't find the details, just give us a call here at the IPA office.
Yep.
Call Nina.
Cool. Yeah, and only
Thanks,
Nina.
Thanks, Pete.
Yeah.
03-9600-4744.
Well, I'll just give the URL again. truearrowevents.com/Dr.Peterson-tour. Anyway, cool. So we'll now go to our interviews with Jacinta Price and Andrew Bushnell. A lot of fun chats, really interesting stuff. But Nina, before we do that, we've got to do our version of an ad read and talk about IPA membership.
Yes, so IPA is always open its membership. So if you have not joined our membership program, just joined. And if you go to our website, ipa.org.au, there is a join button. Just click on that fill in all details, and you can join as low as $22.
That's a bargain. And what do you get out of this membership?
Definitely, you'll get IPA reviews, and then
you got
emails.
Don't let Pete distract you.
Pete's always distracting me. So you'll get subscriptions, free subscriptions, or 4 editions of IPA reviews each year. And also, you'll get weekly emails from James Bolt, Peter, Pete Gregory, and of course, Morgan Bag.
Mm-hmm. The Hey, What Did I Miss email?
Email.
Back next week.
That's okay. And
week after? Anyway, we'll discuss later.
And invitations to IPA events.
Yes, cool. And so thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. Hopefully you guys are enjoying it. Hopefully you guys are subscribed on iTunes, SoundCloud, and our website. That's where you can download it. Make sure you're telling your friends about it. Make sure they're subscribed too. And make sure you're leaving us those 5-star reviews on iTunes because they are very tasty.
Wow.
Just seeing if people are still paying attention. Also, if you guys want to keep up with what the IPA is doing, make sure you're liking us on Facebook and Twitter. Cool. We'll now go to our interviews. Okay, we are now joined by Jacinta Numbajimba Price, Alice Springs Town Councillor and academic with the Centre for Independent Studies. Now, Jacinta, whether Australia should recognise the 26th of January as Australia Day is all over the news at the moment. Today, the Australia Institute released a poll saying that 56% of Australians don't mind when it's held just as long as it is a national day of celebration. Interestingly, they did not release poll numbers for should the date be changed at all, but that's whether or not they asked it. Jacinta, what are your views on Australia Day and whether it should be changed?
Look, I think it's pretty clear. My views are that I think we should stay on the 26th of January because it is a significant date in our country's history. And if we were to change the day, well, we can't focus on what happened in our country's history. It's ignoring what went on. And I'm a true believer in being able to, I think all Australians need to learn our history a lot better, the Aboriginal side and the non-Aboriginal side. I mean, if you ask, any sort of Australian, everyday Australian, what the name of the first Prime Minister of Australia is, you can guarantee that 99% of the time people will not know. So generally, I think Australians, as Australians, we don't really know that much about our history. So I think it is really important to learn that. And changing the date of Australia Day will, I guess, disregard that part of our history, which is very important for the good and the bad. And if we're to grow as a nation, well, we need to take it all with us. It is who we are as a nation, and ignoring it doesn't change that.
Absolutely. One thing I did find interesting from that Australia Day poll is that most people don't really know why Australia Day is on the 26th of January. And it's just, yeah, how do we have all the information in front of us and we still have this debate?
Jacinta, yeah. So just in regards to your view of Australia Day, what's been your reaction? What's been the reaction to that from the general public, from the general public on social media, from politicians, and from other Indigenous activists?
Well, it's been mixed. Mostly, it has been there's been an incredible outpour of support from day to day, everyday Australians of many different backgrounds, whether they're white Australians or Australians who have come from other countries and made this place their home, and other Aboriginal people that have come out in support of maintaining the day, and those who were once for, you know, changing the date. But since, you know, hearing the arguments I have put forward, they've changed their mind and thought, no, it's actually a good idea to remain on the day. And, yeah, the support just keeps growing. And I think generally, I think most Australians just would be happy to just remain on the 26th of January.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people are coming out in support of you. But I've also found it quite interesting online how many people have sort of come out and quite viciously attacked you for your views. What has it sort of told you about the state of debate in Australia, if you can say a completely rational argument and get some of the abuse that you've copped?
It is absolutely drawn some of the most, you know, nasty sort of people out of the woodwork who've come out and attacked me. And it also has exposed the very, very dark side to Aboriginal politics. I guess, you know, there's this general sort of idea that Aboriginal people all think is one, which is utterly untrue. And we're all individuals with our own different minds and thinking. But if you're a free thinker, you're attacked. And I think this is one of the main reasons why Aboriginal people are behind the eight ball, is because, you know, if you want to be a leader, well, then you can expect to be viciously attacked for standing up and having an opinion, and it's hindering our progress. You know, I think we need to get to the point where it is okay to voice an opinion that is different without being attacked, and respectfully debate such issues instead of, you know, like I've had death threats and I've been told to die. They hope I die a very painful death. I guess I'm lucky. I'm one of these thick-skinned people who will hear those sorts of comments and just use that as fuel to continue fighting for what I believe in.
Absolutely, yeah. So you bring up the concept of like where this is in Aboriginal politics. Now, when it gets covered in the Australian media, there's sort of an idea that there's like this homogenous opinion amongst Indigenous people that the date should be changed. Do you share that view that all Indigenous people, I mean, obviously you've said yourself that you're against changing the date, but the idea that there's just one Indigenous view of Australia Day?
It is ridiculous to think that. And, you know, the argument that you hear from people like Dean Atali that we need to listen to the First Nations people. Well, which First Nations people are you talking about? Because we've all got differing views on the topic. And there are a lot of us who want to get on with our fellow Australians without the division, who have been getting on with our fellow Australians. There are those of us with mixed background who recognise the fact that we have in our ancestry, those that have come across in our history because of the First Fleet, as well as our ancestors that were first here. So it's complex. And what do we do for those of us who are, you know, Blackfoot and Whitefoot at the same time? Are we supposed to just take the side of the angry Blacktivist and say, well, you know, we want to change the date because it's apparently making people feel upset? I mean, I've had, you know, I've got Aboriginal women coming to me saying, look, this is ridiculous. I've been a victim of domestic and family violence and sexual abuse as a child. And for these privileged people to be banging on about changing the date of Australia Day, this is the most important issue. It disgusts me because it is drowning out the voices of those who are actual real victims. They'd rather get on with things with their fellow Australians. And they don't want the date taken away from them for what it means to be Australian to them.
Jacinta, you touched on that briefly just then. Do you think this debate about Australia Day is taking oxygen away from much more important and pressing issues facing Indigenous communities in Australia?
Absolutely. I mean, if this much energy was invested into actually, putting in the spotlight these very serious and critical issues for Aboriginal people, imagine what we could do to change those circumstances for the most marginalised people. I mean, if people actually chose to mark the streets in the numbers that they do for the for changing the date of Australia Day, for the victims of family and domestic violence, for Aboriginal women and children, well, then we might actually get around to solving those issues and doing it together. But it does come from a privileged viewpoint to be able to, march to change the date, which isn't going to make any significant impact whatsoever on the ground in the lives of the most marginalised.
Absolutely. And do you sort of feel that we get to a point where because Australia Day comes across in the news every year, it's a huge opportunity for politicians who want to sort of curry favour with, the certain, convicted outrage community. They get up, they get on the grandstand saying, I really care about Indigenous issues, I want the date changed. And that sort of gives them a free pass to just not talk about these issues for another 10 months when it's like real issues going on. So do you do you reckon it actually sort of not so much takes oxygen away as just absolutely suppresses discussion about these other issues?
Yes, it does. And it's a complete cop-out and it's a pretend way to act like you actually care for Aboriginal people. I mean, I've never heard Di Natale come out and say that he is outraged by the levels of, family and domestic violence that occurs in Aboriginal communities. I've never once heard him say that, but he can get up and say that he's outraged on behalf of the Aboriginal activists who claim that the day celebrates genocide and colonisation. It's just that's just rhetoric. It is just rhetoric and it's meaningless and it has no standing, in my view, for those who are the real victims.
Jacinta, I want to change direction now just slightly. So you're a councillor in Alice Springs, so obviously you deal firsthand with a lot of the issues facing Indigenous communities. I know they're really complicated issues the solutions to the problems facing Indigenous communities are really difficult, but what are one or two starting points do you think in terms of dealing with those actual practical problems?
I think starting points begin with Aboriginal people ourselves. A lot of these issues are impacting upon our people, our family members. They're close to our homes. And, a lot of the time the rhetoric that we hear is that this has been caused, the demise of Aboriginal people has been caused by racism and colonisation, and the same, words we've used over and over again. But what we don't actually acknowledge is the fact that there are cultural factors that perpetuate the cycle, that hinder our progress. And we really have to get to a point where we go, okay, so we understand what our history has contributed to this mess, but what have we contributed to this mess? And what do we need to do as Aboriginal people to turn this situation around? That requires taking responsibility and not this continual shifting of blame onto, government and white Australians. And if we started there, and if we started with our own homes and our own families and our own communities, I believe that's where the changes need to begin, need to start at. We've seen that so many billions of dollars are spent on programs and, for Aboriginal people to better their lives, but we're not seeing that much change. Where we are seeing the changes is in built-up areas where services are more readily available to Aboriginal people. But those who are most marginalised are those whose first language is not English and who live in remote parts of the country. And again, we've got to look at more practical ways to solve our problems, but we have got to take charge of that ourselves.
So Jacinta, just changing tracks for a little bit. So as Pete said, you're a town councillor in Alice Springs. I think you were elected in 2015, so relatively at the start of your political career. How would you describe yourself politically? Sort of conservative, a classical liberal, libertarian? And what are the sort of views around the sort of Alice Springs and the wider culture that we sort of don't really hear from in the main cities?
Sure. Well, I'm centre right. That's what I guess I describe myself. I'm a conservative. I am part of the Country Liberal Party. And look, a lot of the issues that we face in our community are issues like youth crime. Well, that is one of the major issues at the moment that we are faced with, is youth crime and the fact that we've got alcohol fueled violence through our streets, and it's impacting Aboriginal people. 25% of our population is Indigenous, so therefore Indigenous issues are everybody's issues. And you know, they're the sorts of issues that we need to be able to focus on as a community. And that I'm currently working on with beginning to work with a lot more Aboriginal women to look at finding solutions from, you know, an Aboriginal woman's standpoint. I think for women, our status within the community, we've always been second to Aboriginal men. And it's time now that changed, and we took more of a role of being able to come up with solutions for our community. But in terms of me politically, that's where I'm aligned. And following on from, of course, my mother was a minister in the Country Liberal Party in the Liberal government, previous to the current Labor government.
Jacinta, we get told, so we're located in Melbourne, obviously, we get told in the eastern states that the left, so the Labor Party and the Greens, are the party for Indigenous people, and that the conservative side of politics doesn't care about Indigenous people. Are you a real rarity in that you're an Indigenous activist who is of the centre-right persuasion, or is that a bit of a misconception? And in fact, amongst ordinary Indigenous people and amongst Indigenous activists, there is a much more even spread along the political spectrum?
Look, I think it's definitely changing. There are a lot more conservative Aboriginal people out there, but people like to believe the myth that the left and the Greens and Labor are the parties for Aboriginal people. Well, they haven't done much in terms of trying to assist Aboriginal people over the years, as we've seen. You know, if we look at some of political history, you know, the White Australia policy was a Labor policy and something that the Liberals came and changed and made change to. It was the Liberals who assisted with Aboriginal people being able to gain the vote during the referendum. You know, people don't really recognise, they perpetuate this myth, but it's just not true. And what I'm seeing more and more of now is that the Labor and the left want to continue to peddle this victimhood mentality of Aboriginal people and see us as these victims that need to be saved. Well, that doesn't empower us. But, you know, I look at the way the conservative idea about one being able to stand on their own two feet, and this is what we need to instill for Aboriginal people. We don't need to be these museum pieces constantly held back. We need to be able to join the modern world and become, you know, part of an Australian economy and stand on our own two feet and not constantly have our hand out, you know, to welfare and having other people do things for us, like Labor and the Greens. And that is changing. And a lot of people, I mean, don't get me wrong, my family were once Labor supporters, and, you know, we definitely were aligned to the left. But in more recent years, because we've seen lack of real work being done by Labor, we've lost interest in supporting them, because they're not prepared to actually listen to how things need to be done. They think they know the answers already.
Jacinta, that was a really great chat. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we're now joined by IPA Research Fellow Andrew Bushnell. Welcome back to the show. Good to have you.
It's good to be back after a long period without having me on the show.
Whack! This has come out firing.
All right. Okay.
But no, because it's recently been brought to my attention that there's actually a huge groundswell.
What are you saying, huge?
Of support for having me back on the
show. I'd say vocal.
What is that? A noisy minority.
Yeah.
Well, anyway. that's how the world works, you know. One man can change the world.
And are you that man, Andrew Bushnell?
Andrew Bushnell's the man.
Are you the man to change the world?
Well, no, because, you know, I think change is bad. I'm a conservative. I mean, let's just keep things as they are as much as possible. Yeah. And certainly if you're going to go changing things, don't involve me.
I think change is bad. The Andrew Bushnell story. That should be the name of your autobiography.
All right. If I could bring order to this.
Take control.
We had some extra stuff we need to talk to you about, Andrew. So obviously, Victoria, last few weeks, has been inundated with chat about African gang violence. So last year, you wrote a piece called How to Stop a Crime Wave, which was sort of more talking about how this issue was dealt with New York. But based on that, what do you think the criminal justice response to this issue should be?
Well, at the risk of contradicting myself immediately, things need to change. What we have here in Victoria is, we've seen, in the most recent quarterly statistics, the overall crime rate went down, but we're still seeing over the last 2 years a massive increase in serious crimes like assault, sexual offending. And one of the things that I talk about in that piece in the IPA review, and one of the things that's been really successful in New York, is this idea of targeted policing. So we know that we have a lot of money going into policing, a lot of money going into prisons, as I've sort of described at length on this show and elsewhere, that we have in Australia, we actually have a really high level of spending in these areas. But you can argue, and I think should argue, that this money isn't really being targeted necessarily to where we need it. And the example I always give of that is, if you go to one of the safest train stations in Melbourne, say Ashburton or Glen Iris or a place like that, you will see like two community protection officers just standing there chatting.
Yeah, often on the wrong side when the trains get off. They're on the other side. I'm just like,
well,
what are
I'm
you
sure that they even change between platforms. They just sort of stand
there.
Yeah, yeah. And it would be so boring.
And it would be really boring. It's not really their fault that there's no crime in Ashburton. But there is crime elsewhere in the city. For example, a report by the Jesuit, Social Services, said that 50% of the crime in this state comes from 6 postcodes. So we know that we can target resources more effectively. And in New York, what they did was they have this system called CompStat, where they look at where the offending is happening and they try and move police into there. And they have at a local level, they have local police division heads responsible for the statistics in their areas. Now, I'm not saying that we have to adopt their system wholesale. And to a certain extent, we do have statistical modelling like that. But what I am saying is that we need to be sort of more aggressive in that. And then what they found in New York is that it works better if it comes along with what's called community policing, which is that you have to have outreach into these communities where you're pushing more resources to sort of explain why they might start seeing more police patrols and things like that. And so they don't feel like they're under siege. Because we've got to remember that even in the highest crime areas, most people, overwhelming majority of people, are law-abiding.
Mm.
We need to remember that most people are law-abiding. We need to remember that the majority of victims are from these same communities.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Another way of thinking about targeted policing is as needs-based policing. There's a greater need for policing in those areas to keep those people safe, and that's what we should do. So that should be the highest priority.
Yeah, so that sounds like a pretty common sense approach of just like, there's a demand here. Obviously, we need to put it with needs. So why isn't the state government doing this?
Well, I think the problem we have here in Victoria is that, and sort of what I've heard from the people I've talked about this with, mostly like former policemen, believe that the police force in Victoria has become politicised, and that the goals of the police force are sort of wrapped up with the political ambitions of the police minister and the government here. And the government here has a particular story it wants to tell about diversity and the success of multiculturalism and things like that. And that's fine. That's their political prerogative. They were elected in part to tell the sort of story that their voters want to hear. But it can't stop them from taking steps when there's an obvious problem. And that's what we're seeing with this crime wave and with the unfortunate connection between this crime wave and particular demographic groups who seem to be overrepresented amongst the offenders.
Okay, so is this connected to, I know you wrote about this in your piece last year, broken windows policing. Is that something that we support?
Yeah, so broken windows policing is this idea...
Where we allow police to break windows? Is that
it's a radical, radical approach.
Yeah, it sort of demonstrates anger and scares the people.
Yeah, know it doesn't work until it doesn't.
Broken windows policing is this idea that if you tolerate very small breaches of public order, like, say, broken windows, then that sends a signal that behaviour like that will be tolerated and you get worse and worse behaviour. So by cracking down on small-scale things like broken windows and graffiti and these kind of small-scale breaches of public order, you create more, you know, create a more orderly environment. You raise people's expectations about how they're supposed to behave.
They're not going to take jaywalking from us, though. We had this conversation yesterday.
No. I mean, if they cracked down on jaywalking, the city just would not function.
Exactly.
I'm the best jaywalker in Melbourne.
Oh, no.
No.
Well, we can fight this out later, because all three of us have claimed to be the best jaywalker
this is
in Melbourne
make,
at
this
one point.
This is going to make for a great headline, but it's like half of the IPA gets wiped out in one car crash. Just first one to run across a road.
First one to get run over loses.
Go down to the Princess Freeway.
Let's do it.
Yeah, but this idea of broken windows policing is somewhat controversial, just because some people think that it is a distraction or it's just like a really convenient story. But you can see that it makes sense. And in that piece, I talk about this idea of the Overton window, which is in politics, the Overton window is the range of acceptable ideas in public debate. And if you bring up ideas from outside this window, people are apt to think that you're crazy and not really be responsive. But by talking about ideas in the right way, you can shift this window and move what people think is the proper bounds of the conversation. And you've got to think about broken windows in the same way, that right now we seem to have an increasingly high tolerance for public disorder. And broken windows is, at the very least, a way of rhetorically shifting that to try and reduce people's tolerance for some of the disorder that we really see every day on the streets of Melbourne. And I'm talking here about, you know, public urination and, you know, crazy people on drugs just wandering about.
Assaulting,
you know,
Simon Breeny.
Assaulting Simon Breeny and putting in danger his coif or whatever, his hairdo. No. So that is a good example that what happened to Simon is terribly unfortunate, but... you know, it's the sort of thing that you do see if we don't have any expectation that in public that our public spaces will be policed such that there aren't just crazy people wandering about, then eventually one of these crazy people is going to escalate his behaviour, and the result is someone like Simon, just an innocent passerby, gets thrown onto the road, and it could have been much worse.
Yeah.
So that's the idea, is just to shift the conversation about what's acceptable.
So we know that criminal justice is a very important area of work for the IPA. What's on the agenda for 2018?
Well, right now I'm working on a report that is just going to be an overview of community corrections in Australia across the different jurisdictions that we have here. The idea there is that, you know, we've talked a lot about reducing incarceration by imposing alternative punishments. Most of these take place in the community, things like community service and home detention, fines, restitution orders. And so the idea is to just provide an overview of how these programs are working right now, what they really are, and then just to offer some ideas about how we might move those closer to the priorities that we have and that we think would work. And there's an overlap here with the work that the IPA continues to do in this idea of dignity of work, that for individuals to live fulfilling, self-contained lives, they really need to be committed to work and being productive. And this is true, for offenders, that the goal of the criminal justice system is to correct people's behaviour. And a large part of correcting people's behaviour is to get them to see the benefit of deferring their gratification from the immediate gains that you might get from committing, say, a property crime or any other kind of crime, to, you know, playing by the rules and getting a deferred gain further down the track. You know, and that's what you and I do, you know, we all do every day.
To varying degrees.
Yeah, I wouldn't call mine gains, but yeah, we'll see what happens.
No. You've been doing well with your diet. You've been eating salads every day, so mm-hmm. they're no gains at the moment.
Yeah,
for Bolt.
Yeah, he's looking
personality top-notch. Season he's is
looking,
over.
Looking trim.
Thank you. Cool. I'll make sure we leave that part in there. but we are. So I do want to move on. So Bushnell, you had an article today that people can read on our website with IPA research fellow Daniel Wild. Now, you guys were talking about a Mikkel Institute report, which came out recently, talking about inequality. Now, inequality, obviously, something we talked to Daniel a lot about recently. So if you guys really want to get into the nitty-gritty economic side of inequality, go back and listen to those episodes. But just on the specifics of this Mikkel Institute report, what were your issues with it?
So, again, it's this what we're trying to do with this conversation is move it closer to this idea of opportunity. So you can start to see the connecting thread between a lot of the work that's going on at the IPA right now is about how do we get people to into work and to take advantage of our, you know, traditional institutions that we know make for good lives for most people. So staying in school until you finish, getting a job, getting married and staying married. We know that there's a kind of a path that leads to a good life for most people. Now, obviously, if you're an extraordinary person, then you might deviate from this path.
I don't think Leonardo DiCaprio is settling down to the marriage system
anytime soon. Or you might be Ernest Hemingway or something, and you have several wives and be a genius and write the great books and things like that. But chances
are... Did he finish on the good path, though?
Yeah, it didn't
Let's
end on a good note
it.
For
Let's
him.
Think about that.
And you're probably not Hemingway. Like as a general rule in life,
it's pretty rough.
this is another possible title for your your autobiography.
You're
probably not Hemingway. There's a caveat there.
Sometimes
guide to life.
Sometimes we present this idea in society that the example you should try and follow are the really extraordinary people in society, and that's great, and everyone should have dreams. But we shouldn't frame success in a way that if you're not Michael Jordan, you've failed, because you haven't. And there's a lot of ways to live a good life. But there's a real path, there's a sort of a structure to it that we know produces happy, productive, successful people. So the issue around inequality is kind of a misnomer, because the distribution of wealth across society doesn't really change whether or not most people are meeting the threshold of opportunity. Now, we do have pockets in Australia where you could realistically say that there's a lack of opportunity. And the issue there is that how do we get people to that threshold where you can say that they have an opportunity to lead a good life? And as Dan and I argue in that piece today, often the solution to that is going to be less government, not more. You know, how do you build a business for yourself? Well, you need to do that for yourself. The government can't do that for you. All the government can do is put
Barack
barriers.
Obama would say differently, but continue.
Yeah, you didn't build that. No, but we're saying not only did people build those businesses, but they can build new ones. And the idea is that the government can't or shouldn't just unnecessarily throw barriers up in front of people who are trying to do the right thing, trying to stay on this path of building good self-contained lives. And so the solution when we talk about opportunity and we talk about people meeting this threshold, often we just need government to get out of the way and let people build these meaningful institutions in civil society, in business. And that's the direction that we want to move this conversation.
We're almost out of time, but I would like to ask one more question. So we talk about the rejuvenation of these cultural institutions that enable people to live a good life. And obviously government getting out of the way is one step. What are other steps to do that? Because I know that getting government out of the way in some aspects will have some positive benefits, but a lot of those things are reliant on stuff that isn't government. Is there anything else that we talk about that could enable that to occur?
I think it's a good question, Pete.
It is. I don't think we...
No. The answer really is that you just have to get out and do it yourself. People can't do these things for you. You know, you volunteer at your cricket club. You know, local cricket clubs work on a basis of people pitching in. Now, no one can force you to do that. You have to want to do it. And in fact, that's what makes it meaningful, is that you have a group of people who all want to pitch in and help to make this club something that's really enjoyable for everyone. That's the kind of attitude that we need. And it's kind of impeded when people start to think that that the state will do these things for us, because you develop a kind of an expectation that that's how things not only will be but should be, whereas there is a different way of thinking about this, which is that if you want to have a meaningful association in your life, you can go out and form one, you know, go to church, go to your, go play cricket at a club, you know, you form a family. Pub trivia. Mm. I mean, these things.
It's my family.
I mean, the state can't do these. States can't do these things for you. I mean, Google can do that last one for you.
Yeah, yeah. But you get caught for cheating, so don't do that.
Yeah. So don't cheat.
Yeah.
But you know, you probably would.
Wow.
They don't hand out winning prizes in a raffle. Well, they do actually. Anyway, Andrew, thank you so much for joining us on the show.
Thanks, mate.
Cheers.
Okay, thank you to Jacinta Price and Andrew Bushnell for that chat. So we will now go to a few stories from around the world that kind of made us laugh this week. If I may start, Pete.
You can start, James.
Okay, cool. So this is, unless you guys have been living under a rock or probably more likely a bomb shelter for the last week, Hawaii had a bit of a scare. Someone pressed the wrong button. They were supposed to press the test alarm to send out to the state that they're about to die, but they press the real alarm.
Yeah.
So basically a bunch of Hawaii people are at breakfast and suddenly their phone goes off. This is not a drill. Please seek immediate shelter. Ballistic missile headed for Hawaii.
Is this every person in Hawaii?
Well, basically.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, word traveled fast, like when you saw some of the videos that were coming out about it.
Yeah.
So
we've put the odd typo in, hey?
Yeah.
The odd typo.
Yeah, once every few months.
But
have not told an entire state of people that they're about to die.
Something to aim for, maybe.
Yeah. And it's not just people who live in Hawaii, but it's also like people who are holidaying there. Like, people who are just chilling out at the breakfast table at the hotel buffet. Suddenly get the message you're about to die.
Yeah.
It's pretty creepy, pretty scary stuff. A lot of, you know, people obviously very panicked. So here's where stuff gets pretty interesting for me. The guy's not fired.
Oh.
How do you not get fired?
He's not fired.
No, he's being reassigned.
Nina's outraged.
And the person in front of the media is like, he feels terrible for what happened. He's really ashamed. He's reassigned to a spot where he's not able to press the button anymore.
Everyone deserves a second chance.
Everyone does. But it's like, so the thing I said, like, obviously, you know, fans of the IPA for the last year would have known that we last year released a report saying how hard it is for public servants to get fired or to, you know, be disciplined in any way. Problem is bad in Australia. It's not that bad. It's not as bad as the US where you can tell an entire state of people they're about to die and you still won't get fired.
Yeah, exactly. We got texts here in Melbourne about those allegedly massively severe flooding that was meant to occur.
Yeah.
And it didn't rain at all the next day.
So a few reactions happened from the story, which I found were really funny. One guy made a video of himself on the golf course. He's just hanging out on the golf course and he's talking to camera and he says, if you're reading this, I didn't make it out. I just got a message that there's a ballistic missile headed on the way. I'm too far away from any bomb shelter. And also I just made par on the last hole and I smoked my last shot.
Yep.
I'm dying on this golf course.
Yeah. We're going to go out of high.
Yeah. This other one, a friend of his texts his buddy on holidays, and the buddy says, yeah, it was crazy. People were running out of the hotel breakfast place screaming. And he says, what did you do? I said, I stayed. The lines cleared up so quickly.
What would you do? It's just like, well, I can't. I mean, are there measures in place? What are the measures in place?
There's like videos of like parents putting their children down storm drains, like trying to keep them safe, and like, you know, people like closing windows and stuff like that. But yeah, pretty scary stuff. I wouldn't want to be known. How does it take half an hour for everyone to be like, false alarm? Like for 38 minutes, people thought they were about to die. And then it's like, false alarm.
The next minute, go, didn't mean to press that button. Bang, straight, do not. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you guys see this, like the computer that's set up?
No.
It's like a drop-down screen of like 10.
Yeah.
One of them's called test, one of them isn't. And it's just one button. No, two buttons. It's like one, do you really want to press this button, yes or no? It's not just like...
There's got to be more than that.
Apparently Hawaii's now moved to a two-button system.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which I would have thought was necessary.
Yeah.
My idea would be something where, you know, you put your two people have to put in the key in at the exact same time and like a scanner comes down and scans their eyes and then the thing can go out.
Yeah.
Apparently just one button.
Well, you wouldn't want it to not go out because there was too many measures, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I think Hawaii's got enough press for now.
Well, I have one
Oh,
more
no,
thing.
It hasn't. Sorry, go on.
Do you reckon there's someone still in a bomb shelter and it's like going to be when those Japanese soldiers didn't surrender up?
They got no reception, so they didn't get the follow-up.
Yeah, so it's like 38 years. They'll just come out. Anyway, food for thought.
Maybe you get fired then.
It's a good movie.
All right, so North and South Korea are marching together in the opening ceremony and competing together at the Winter Olympics next month in Pyeongchang, which Nina tells me is in South Korea, because Nina's a massive fan of K-pop. And this is the first time this has happened since the 2006 Winter Olympics, where North and South Korea will be walking out together in the opening ceremony and competing together. James has a few opinions on this.
Well, obviously, this is a pretty cool story. Like, I've been saying to my friends, like, obviously, you know, it's happened before 10 years ago.
But happened in Sydney.
2 months, yeah, 2 months ago, if you said, what's the number one story coming out of Korea this week? It would have been a million years before, I guess, they were marching under one banner at the Olympics, just from where the sort of talk was.
That's true, actually.
Yeah. My favorite part, thank you, man. I've been practicing. I also have another more narrow point to make. North Korea will send, this comes from the article, North Korea will send a 550-member delegation to the Games, which includes 230 cheerleaders, 140 artists, and 30 Taekwondo players. My point is, if 370 people out of your 550-member delegation are cheerleaders and artists, I think you have to admit that free markets are better than communism. Like, if nearly 75% of your Olympic contingent are people not related to the Olympics, free markets kind of win.
That will be the thing. Although, in communism's defense, they do better.
New name for the podcast.
They do better, like, public kind of propaganda celebrations. Yeah, exactly. So when they have those public marches through the street,
yeah,
and they've got all those people waving flags at the same time,
yeah,
that happens in communist countries better than in non-communist
countries. Yeah, because slightly off camera is the armed policeman just saying, hang on, you're a bit out of time there.
And the grinding poverty.
Yeah, exactly. I also like when you've got those like time lapses of the North Korean marches where it's just less and less tanks as they have to sell them off.
Yeah.
It's just like, come on, guys, we win.
Yeah.
Another part of this story that isn't getting as much coverage. Everyone was freaking out when Trump tweeted that, like, you know, I've got a bigger button than Kim Jong-un does.
Yeah, Nina-esque.
Yeah, Nina-esque. Because you were just saying before how you've got a bigger button than we do for the podcast.
Oh, yeah, true.
So is Trump right now? Like,
yeah. Has he reined them in?
So President Moon Jae-in of South Korea said in a nationally televised news conference, I'm giving a lot of credit to President Trump. I'm expressing my gratitude after they started talks for the first time in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this probably won't get a lot of coverage.
One for Mary Kissel, that one.
Mm.
Geopolitics.
Talk to her again. Cool. Pete, let's go to... Oh, so this is a really funny story for you guys. Switzerland have a very sort of direct democracy set up, especially in regards to citizenship. Like in towns, not states or countries, but towns can have a say on whether an individual person can move into become a Swiss citizen if they're in the town. So it's quite localized democracy. So it led to this story. A woman has been denied a second application for a Swiss passport after local residents took offense to her rejection of traditions and her, quote, annoying campaigning. Nancy Holton, 42, born in the Netherlands, moved to Switzerland when she was 8. She's fluent in Swiss, German, and her children have Swiss citizenship. But the animal rights campaign activist has campaigned publicly against the local traditions of putting bells around cows' necks and piglet racing. So they're just like, you know what? You don't get to be Swiss.
Piglet racing sounds awesome.
I don't know what
the problem is. That's the big take out of this.
Yeah, yeah. So a few things from the story I really like. So she describes herself as a freelance journalist, model, and activist.
Ooh.
So already...
Not a great combination.
I was a Swiss citizen, and it's like this freelance journalist, model, and activist wants to move in.
Wow.
I'm on the back foot.
So hang on, so she already lives there?
Yeah, she's lived there since she was 11. She wants citizenship.
Okay.
And the Swiss town gets a say, and the Swiss town has said, no, you don't respect Swiss customs.
Because you're annoying.
So another part from this quote... So one of her campaigns was against, obviously, cows wearing a cowbell around their neck. She said, the sound the cowbells make is 100 decibels. It's comparable to a pneumatic drill. We would also not want such a thing hanging close to our ears, she repeatedly told the media. And I guess the Swiss town just feel the same way about her.
Boom, boom. What's the noise? What's the drum noise?
Cool. So, Pete, you got one.
Yes. So, James, cryptocurrency.
Mm.
Now...
I was waiting for this.
I've done a bit of research.
Yep.
Is it telling?
Really?
It had a massive crash during the week.
Yeah.
And James suddenly stopped telling me every 5 minutes about how his Bitcoin portfolio was going. But I have noticed upon doing research this morning that cryptocurrency prices have bounced back 65% after severe sell-off.
Mm-hmm.
So James is now doing his happy dance because his portfolio is worth 35% less.
And I use the opportunity to buy more. I am now a venture capitalist and I will be treated as such.
Yeah, well, so...
Yeah, but like, you know, you bring up the Bitcoin, I'm just like, oh, Pete thinks he's got me, I'm going to come back. It takes a sting out when you already admit defeat.
Well, it hasn't come back 100%. Like, you're happy and it's only come back 65%.
Yeah, well, I'm still in the green. as the saying would go.
But so cool. You know, being flooded the bank in the green.
I've got a story.
Yeah, okay.
Unless I've got more Bitcoin stuff. Nah, it's just parry back at you.
Bit of padding.
Yeah, okay, cool. There's no padding in this podcast.
That's what we should call it.
Malcolm Turnbull, obviously, he's in Victoria at the moment. Malcolm Turnbull and James Molino is standing in the place of Premier while Daniel Andrews is in India on an official trip.
Premier.
Yes.
Not Premier.
Premier. He's our Premier, but anyway. They were both in Geelong to announce a deal with between the Commonwealth, state and local governments to give the regional city greater priority for major projects. But a bit of a showdown as to who was going to get the last word in the "how are you guys going" question.
Yeah.
And Malcolm, in terms of what you can do to assist, well, there's firearms legislation in the Victorian Parliament. So the best thing you can do, Malcolm, for Victoria is get on the phone, talk to the mobster's mate, Matthew Guy, and get the Liberal Party to support legislation.
Now, James, I'm not... I understand why you've had to have...
If we're going to talk about law and order, it's important to get some facts on the table.
All right. Well, let's raise the tone of it. Let me talk about my trip to Japan.
Just two blokes who really want to have the last word.
Yeah. Just a couple of alpha bulls fighting it out.
Just absolutely locking horns.
Can I ask you?
Go.
Sorry, I want to ask you a question. Yep. Is the awkward press conference? I feel like that's coming in as a political thing because there was one last year in South Australia. Is that true? Has this always happened and I just didn't notice it?
I don't know. But I respect it for James Molino because you're like, look, when do I get to be the acting premier? When do I get my face on the camera?
Yep.
I'm here. I'm just going to...
Pay MC.
I'm just going to conference cuck Malcolm Turnbull.
Bang, bang. Conference cuck. That's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what... Did you think of that?
Yes.
That's good.
Thank you.
The old conference cuck.
If I can bring it back to... I can bring it back to Turnbull. Let me talk about my trip to Japan is not the most threatening of demands. When he just starts yelling at him, let me talk about my trip to Japan. I mean, it's not exactly Trump going out to the journalists yesterday.
Yeah, which you might have seen. Check out the internet.
Cool. So, Pete, you've got a rant.
Yeah, so I think I kind of want to...
That's all you've said to me is just I've got a rant.
Well, not a rant.
About straws.
I want to democratize the podcast.
Okay.
So I've had a few suggestions for topics from listeners.
I think Nina's still the autocrat of the podcast.
Yeah.
Just is dancing in her court.
Well, I'm hoping that she'll loosen her grip on power just a little bit and let you know, the flowers of freedom bloom.
I love power.
But I ain't spending any time on it.
Extra power.
Is that what you're going for with the let the flowers
bloom? No, but that's good. All right. That's good. Okay. Yeah, we unite the power, Nina. Yeah, we got that. So a listener sent me a message via social media.
Mm-hmm.
He goes by the pseudonym DJ God.
DJ God.
The alias.
Okay.
So what is it?
Is it God?
No.
Were you contacted by God?
I wasn't contacted by God. I was contacted by a local trans DJ who said...
Shout out to our trans DJ listening DJ community.
We've got a few. We do actually have a few.
Oh, wow.
And he said to me, can you please speak about something on the podcast? Hipster bars in inner city Melbourne no longer giving out straws with drinks because it's not environmentally friendly. It's expletive.
Nina, are we allowed to talk about it?
Yeah, go ahead.
But so, what are your thoughts?
Wow, I've encountered this a little bit. It's not really that flagrant. Where I've encountered it, they just don't give you a straw.
Right.
But I think he went to a place where they were like, we don't do straws.
See, my take is I'm completely for this. Get straws out of my face. When someone gives me a rum and coke and they put a straw in it, I will put it out immediately.
But don't you think you
get
want the choice?
Straws out of my face.
Would you like the choice?
No.
Not all no choice is good. Yeah. Do you know what it's we do here, James? Anyway, that's it. So the point of that is, if you want something talked about on the podcast, we've had a couple of suggestions from
become a trans DJ
from the DILF from DJ God from a variety of colourful characters. Send us a message on Twitter, Facebook,
that's it.
The electronic mail. Ring Nina on 0396004704. Yeah.
Okay, cool. That's all we have for the show today. Thank you guys so much for listening. Once again, we are available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and a website. If you want to start telling your friends about it, if they want to get in touch, obviously Pete just read out the bunch of ways you guys can get in touch with us. And make sure you're leaving us 5-star reviews on iTunes. And if you want to keep up to date with the stuff that the IPA does around the podcast, make sure you guys are liking us on Facebook and Twitter. Nina, how could people take an even more proactive step into becoming part of the IPA by becoming a member?
Just join up. Just go to
visit. All right, cool.
Well, what else? Just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and then click on that join button, fill in your details, and we'll send you a beautiful membership pack.
Mm-hmm.
And you can join as low as $22 for a year, which is a bargain for me. And during your membership, you will get 4 editions of IPA reviews, weekly emails from our lovely James Paul, Peter Gregory, and Morgan Bagg.
Mm-hmm.
And also invitations to IPA events.
All right, brilliant. Thank you guys so much. See you guys next week.
Have a great weekend.
Bye. I cherish you, my love. I cherish you.